So I kind of start with a high energy spot, which is about position physics of W and Z bosons. And then I will go on from there to low energy electric observables, muon anomalous magnetic moment, electric dipole moments, and then Laplace flavor violations. So it's, as you see, many of the same topics that David just talked about, but now a little bit more theoretical perspective. So to begin with Z and W boson precision physics, so David has mentioned this already. We can get a prediction of the W boson mass in the standard model from muon decay. That's the best way to get it. In the Fermi model, muon decay is, is described by this four-fermion interaction with the Fermi constant here. This receives QED corrections, which are important to take into account. And fortunately, they have been computed to a high level of precision, including two-loop corrections. In the full standard model, however, there's, of course, instead of a four-fermion interaction, there's the W boson exchange at tree level, which is where the sensitivity to the W mass comes from. And then again, there are additional radiative corrections from weak force exchange and QCD corrections as well. Here's one sample diagram. And so these are contained in this quantity delta R, which I will come back to in a second. The other set of important precision observables in this category comes from properties of the Z boson. These have been measured by LEP and SLC by running E plus E minus collisions on the Z pole peak. Again, in order to extract anything that you're interested in, there are a bunch of corrections that need to be taken into account. First of all, very importantly, there are large QED corrections, especially coming from initial state photon emission. And so they can be written as a convolution of some radiation factor and then something which can be called the hard cross section. And they have a huge effect, as one can see in this plot. So the measured curve is the green one over here. Once you do the deconvolution, you get this curve over here, which is very markedly different. Then additionally, once you have that hard cross section, that's not just getting contributions from Z boson exchange. There are also additional contributions that come from photon exchange and box contributions like these with the W boson. This is not what we are primarily interested about, so we need to subtract them. So we remove those pieces and we are left with this piece over here. This is kind of, you know, mentioned here very quickly, but there are many, many people who worked on this in the 1980s and 1990s, and I'm, you know, not even attempting to give a list of references because it would fill at least two slides. Now, once you have this piece over here, this can now be written as a piece that comes just from Z boson exchange, and we can expand it basically around the pole. The leading part is just the typical Breit-Wigner form over here. And one thing I always like to mention in my talks is kind of old news, but I think it's always worth reminding ourselves is if we write the cross section like this, the parameters that we have here, this Z mass and this Z width, are not the parameters that you read in the PDG. They have different values in the PDG, and the reason being is that for historical reasons, somehow we are stuck with a parametrization that looks like this, which has an additional factor S squared over here, which is not supposed to be there from a theory motivation, but that's what we have. Fortunately, there's a translation from one to the other, so you can relate these two sets of parameters, so the one that theoretically makes sense are actually smaller by some shift amount. In addition to measuring cross sections, the width, partial width, different final states, and so on, we can also measure asymmetries on the Z pole. And here I mention two kinds in particular, which is the forward-backward asymmetry, which measures the difference of whether the final state fermion goes, you know, in the direction of the electron or against the direction of the electron. The other one, if you have polarized electron beams, you can also measure the polarization asymmetry of the incoming electron, whether it's left or right-handed polarized. And additionally, I didn't show that over here, but if you have tau leptons in the final state, you can also measure their polarization, and that gives you additional asymmetries which you can use. All of these, in the context of the standard model at least, are sensitive to the same kind of physics, so they can be written in terms of these asymmetry parameters, which depend on the ratio of the vector and axial vector coupling of the Z boson to fermions. And this ratio is also oftentimes expressed in terms of a quantity called the effective weak mixing angle. So these quantities have been measured to very high precision, in particular at lab, and using other input parameters that we need in order to make predictions within the standard model, we can do a global fit. And well, now that we know all the independent parameters of the standard model, including the Higgs boson mass, we have a kind of complete picture, and the picture works very nicely. So in particular, you see in this plot, here's the top quark mass, here's the Higgs boson mass, and the blue curve is the prediction you get from predicting the W boson mass and comparing with what you get from muon decay. This green area is from measuring Z cross-section and Z widths and branching ratios. And these dotted purple ones is what you get from the asymmetries. And there's a non-trivial overlap between the three of these. And you can use this overlap region to compare with what's known about the top quark mass and the Higgs boson mass. And again, you see this all agrees rather nicely. Now, I should mention, in order to show such a plot, there's a lot of work that has to go into predicting these quantities within the standard model to the required precision. The state of the art right now for the relevant quantities, so this factor delta R for the W boson mass, effective weak mixing angle, and form factors of the Z boson, is basically two-loop corrections. For some of these quantities, we have complete two-loop corrections within the standard model. That means electroweak and QCD. For some of them, only so-called fermionic corrections. That means loops which have at least one closed fermion loop. They are known both from experience and also just from power counting to be numerically dominant. And beyond that, there are also some partial three and four loop corrections, in particular those that are enhanced by powers of the top Yukawa coupling, because that, of course, is pretty large. And with all these results in place, we now have a pretty good situation where the estimated theory error for missing higher order corrections, which is shown over here for a couple of sample quantities, is sufficiently below the experimental uncertainty, which is given over here. So these quantities that I show here is the W boson mass, total Z width, the hadronic cross-section of the Z on the Z peak, so that's E plus E minus 2Z, two hadrons. The branching ratio of Z into BB bar, normalized to all hadrons, and finally the leptonic effective weak mixing angle, so from the asymmetries with leptons in the final state. I should mention along this way, though, that these theory estimates are kind of, by and large, just rough guesses. I mean, some of the other speakers have also talked about this before, in other contexts. So we really ideally want to be in a situation where the theory uncertainty is not just comparable to the experimental one, but actually way below, because we really don't know for sure what the theory error is. There are a number of methods how to estimate it. Here I'm listing a few of them. One possibility is you can just count known prefactors of the missing contributions, like, you know, what coupling constant, if there's some number of colors, some number of fermions, and so on and so forth. If you have computed a few orders in the perturbation series already, you can try to see if there's a certain pattern which you can extrapolate. You can look at the renormalization scale dependence, which works pretty well for QCD corrections, although actually not that well for electroweak corrections. Or you could look at renormalization scheme dependence, so you perform a renormalization in one calculation, say in the on-shell scheme, in another calculation in the MS-bar scheme, and look at the difference between those two. What I should also mention is, of course, when we make the comparison with direct measurements of these quantities and the standard model predictions, besides theory uncertainties, there are also uncertainties from other input parameters that we have to put in. And I will come back to that in a minute. All right, since this conference has LHC in the title, I should say something about the LHC. And in fact, I think there are some useful things we can learn about these precision observables from LHC data. In particular, the LHC is supposed to measure the W boson mass, although we still haven't actually seen any result, but many people are working hard on that. The precision target of that is about 8 MeV or potentially better. That's still uncertain. There are no reliable numbers of that on that. And it will be very challenging to get there. In particular, there are uncertainties from pattern distribution functions, which currently will be, you know, already making this difficult to reach. And also in the modeling, so you need to have very precise Monte Carlo generators, in particular for dealing with photon radiation and stuff like that. In addition, from measuring Z boson production at the LHC, we can also get an independent measure of the leptonic effective weak mixing angle, looking at Z decaying to leptons. The LHC will not be able to surpass the precision that LEP had on this quantity. Nevertheless, I think it is quite interesting to have that result because, as David mentioned earlier, we have the rather unsatisfying situation right now that the two most precise existing measurements of this quantity are highly different, right? One is from the left-right asymmetry at SLD, the other one the forward-backward asymmetry with B hadrons in a final state from LEP. And depending where the LHC result falls, we might learn something about what's going on with this. So I said something that also controlling standard model input parameters is very important because they limit the precision we can reach here. So there's the top quark mass, that's a very important input parameter. Right now, we normally already have on the books a precision on this which is better than 1 GeV, although I think one probably has to take that with a little grain of salt because there are many issues related to that. Not just experimental issues like understanding, say, the BJet energy scale or so, but many theoretical issues. For instance, understanding how hadronization may affect this measurement, if there are color reconnections effects, what exactly is the Monte Carlo generator doing? What's the definition of the top quark mass that goes into it and stuff like that? W boson mass, I mentioned already, currently uncertainty is about 15 MeV. The LHC is probably going to measure that better, so that's very nice. Then a third important input parameter is alpha S, which enters through loops. At tree level, of course, it's not there, but at higher loop orders, it is. The currently single most precise determination of that is using lattice QCD results and applying them to, this is the wrong symbol here, this is supposed to be an Y spectroscopy. And so this is the result you get from that, which is already very good, but actually there's unfortunately a caveat because some other determinations of alpha S, in particular from E plus E minus event shapes, and deep inelastic scattering prefer a value of alpha S which is significantly lower than this one here. So it's a question what's going on here. We need to understand that better, of course, before we can really fully trust something like this.
And the total lattice uncertainty, though, is bigger than that now, isn't it?
Not according to what those people, what the HBQCD collaboration says, but some people are debating whether they did the error estimate properly.
I think the
flag
group
has increased the uncertainty. The flag group is double, but the other uses the state of fermions and the neutrons. Yep. And finally, the last important input parameter is the delta alpha hadronic. That's a shift of the fine structure constant from hadronic loops when you run it from zero, where it's normally defined, up to the Z scale. This can not be calculated from first principles. It's typically taken from data, E plus E minus data, most specifically. Current uncertainty on that is about 10 to the minus 4. And with additional future E plus E minus data, this might still become somewhat better. So looking into the future a bit farther, here I want to quickly flash what we might have if we have a future high luminosity E plus E minus machine. Something like the International Linear Collider or the future Circular Collider or something like that. These machines claim to reach precisions for these quantities that are much higher than what we have from the lab era, about an order of magnitude better. Which, of course, would have highly increased sensitivity to new physics. I think Laura will talk about that on Thursday a little bit. But, of course, poses also a big challenge to theorists in order to match that precision with predictions. Even if we were to have the most significant three-loop corrections computed fully, not just in some approximation, we would reach this level of precision here, which is getting close, but we are still not in a situation where we can safely say, okay, our theory uncertainties are not dominant anymore. In addition, it will also be a challenge to control the parametric uncertainties due to the other input parameters that we are using. It will definitely be necessary to measure all these parameters again at those machines directly. So in particular, the top quark mass, the strong coupling constant, and so forth, potentially also the Z boson mass, if you can do it. Because otherwise, you will not get to these numbers that are shown over here. All right, so now let me move on to low-energy electroweak observables. So these are, in particular, observables that measure parity violation at lower energies, which can be done in a number of channels. So you can look at electron-electron scattering, electron-proton, electron with some bigger nuclei like deuteron, or you can look at neutrino nucleon scattering, or you can look at atomic parity violation. In essence, they all measure diagrams of this sort, where you have basically two fermion lines, and there's an exchange of a Z boson between them. Since we are interested in the parity violating part, there are two contributions here, where either you have an axial vector vertex here and a vector vertex down here, or the opposite. So there are those two pieces. Within the standard model, those two pieces are, of course, related. They are both measuring the same weak mixing angle here, which can be interpreted as a running weak mixing angle at some low scale, the low scale at which this experiment is being performed. So this running is shown over here. It has a kind of funny shape. At every kink, there's some contribution that's basically integrated out in the running. So over here, we integrate out W, Z, and top. Then somewhere here, we integrate out bottom and charm and tau, and here the remaining hadrons and so forth. That's why it has this shape. And you see here right now the precision of various existing measurements. So David has shown it already. These are LEP, LHC, Tevatron, things like this, which have the currently highest precision. And these are various existing lower energy experiments, which right now are more or less in agreement with what the standard model says. But in the future, we will measure many of these quantities to much higher precision. So there is the planned Mueller experiment with electron-electron, various electron-proton experiments, and also planned atomic parity violation measurements. And so these experiments will, first of all, match more or less the precision that we get from lab and therefore provide a complementary test of the standard model. But furthermore, you can also go a bit further beyond the framework of the standard model. For instance, you can say, if I go back over here, you can say instead of writing these two quantities in terms of the same mixing angle, I just take these independent of each other. And you can get information about that, which is shown here. So there's some combination of AV couplings to different quarks, and here the VA and AV coupling. And these different scattering experiments put different lines in this plane, and then you can get the overlap region, which right now agree very nicely with the standard model, which is this tiny black dot here, up over there. And you can also wonder about physics that particularly affects only low energies rather than higher energies. So one example was also shown by David earlier already, which is this dark gauge boson with a mass of around 100 MeV or less. So if one tunes the coupling of this gauge boson to be such that it would explain the G minus 2 discrepancy of the muon, then you can make a prediction of how it would affect those low energy scattering experiments, which are those bands here. There's some sign ambiguity, that's why each of them has two bands. And there really wouldn't be any change at the scale of lab. So you wouldn't affect these measurements at all, but you know, the future measurements like Muller or Q-weak and so on might be able to tell us something about that. So I did kind of mention already G minus 2. Let me move on to that. So we have seen already there's an enormously precise measurement of this quantity. And in order to match and compare that to theory, there's a lot of theory work that has to go into this. So most importantly, there are QED corrections, which have been computed to the amazing level of 5-loop. Here are a subset of the diagrams that are involved to this. And the uncertainty that we now get basically from these, which is the bulk of the corrections, is completely negligible. There are many smaller pieces that go into the predictions. So there are electroweak corrections, which are known both at 1-loop and 2-loop level. Then there are hadronic corrections, which come from hadronic loops in the photon vacuum polarization. And there are blobs, you know, you can put one blob, which is leading order, two blobs, which is next to leading order, and even three blobs. So these are also known. And this hadronic light by light piece. So these are the pieces that have larger uncertainties. And then if you add all these contributions up, you get this prediction over here. And compared to the experiment, one can basically see that there's a discrepancy which is larger than three standard deviations, which is what the whole issue is about. So one question you might ask is about, well, how well do we understand these hadronic effects? They are traditionally taken from E plus E minus data or tau decay data, and then using dispersion relations in order to fold them into the predictions for the muon G minus 2. And there are some issues because different experiments disagree, in particular older and newer experiments, for instance. So you see here, this is a plot where a lot of stuff has been compiled together, and there's quite a bit of spread in various parts of it. Additionally, for a long time, there was actually some discrepancy of whether you used E plus E minus or tau data. You got slightly different results. This seems to have been pretty much resolved now. So this is the situation as it was before. This is the pion form factor taken from tau data divided by the one you get from E plus E minus data. At low energies, it's pretty much exactly one, but here there's somehow some deviation. It turns out that there was a photon row mixing effect, which was underestimated before. Once you put that in, it looks that everything is more like exactly the one line. So instead of taking data, you can also try to use lattice computations, and they are starting to become competitive. The uncertainties are still larger than what we get from data, but you know, it's nice to see that they're consistent, so it doesn't seem like something is completely off. And that's also true for the light-by-light contribution. That actually one cannot take from data so far, but there are model calculations, and there are first lattice results, and they also agree fairly well. Now, if the hadronic stuff is not a problem, well, we might wonder if there's new physics responsible for this discrepancy. And there are different kinds of possibilities. I just flash a few. One of them we have seen already, which is, again, this dark photon. Oops, sorry. Dark photon explanation. So it's a new gauge boson which kinetically mixes with a standard model hypercharge gauge boson. And in order to explain the discrepancy, you want to be in this green band in the plane of mass and mixing parameter. And unfortunately, there are other constraints on this which make it very hard to meet this, and there's only, you know, this tiny corner of parameter space that's still allowed at a 90% confidence level, but maybe 90% confidence is too tight. Then there's the MSSM, which can, of course, explain everything because it has a lot of parameters. In particular, going to large tangent beta helps because it enhances the corrections, which come from loops of sleptons, neutrinos, and gaijinos, like this. And if you put in a bunch of other constraints that are known, you find some parameter space that works, which is shown here by these green dots. So you want typically particle masses of a few hundred GeV, and that works fine. Instead of working in particular models, you could also take a slightly more model-independent approach, just introducing some particles beyond the standard model inside the loops. Starting at one loop, of course, is the easiest thing one can do, and so we might introduce, you know, some new fermions or some new scalars, and just, you know, give them typical couplings and see what happens. And by and large, it turns out if you give them order one, so weak strength couplings, you need new particles with a mass of a few hundred GeV in order to explain this discrepancy, which is a region of parameter space that we are already probing. There are typically no dedicated searches for these kinds of situations, but one could try to recast existing LHC searches, and they cut into this parameter space. So this is shown here for a few examples. So these are different combinations. So this, for instance, assumes we have one singlet scalar and one charged fermion in the loop. Here we go, you know, to a doublet scalar and a triplet fermion and so forth. Here's something with new vector bosons. In each of the plots, these green and yellow regions are the 1-2 sigma regions that explain the G minus 2 discrepancy. And these lines indicate what is excluded from LHC data. So everything below these lines or to the left of these lines is excluded, and you see many of these scenarios already are not viable anymore. The dashed lines indicate what future LHC data at 14 TeV can additionally cut out. All right, so now let me move on to CP violation and electric dipole moments. So as David already mentioned, we have very severe limits on possible CP violation beyond the standard model from these experiments. Typically, one looks at two quantities as benchmarks from a theory point of view. This is the electron and the neutron electric dipole moments. The electron electric dipole moment is most strongly constrained from data from paramagnetic systems because there the electron contribution is enhanced relative to the nucleus contribution. And the current best limit looks like this. It's a very small number. There are some uncertainties that go into this limit, which have been taken into account. These come from nuclear effects. These come from the effects that these are large atoms with many electrons in them. You need to understand those. Unfortunately, additionally, interpreting this number on the theory side is also complicated because there is not only the typical dipole operator that contributes to this, but there are also other contributions. There's, for instance, this operator here, which is sometimes called the spin-independent electron-nucleus interaction. I don't know why spin-independent, because there's actually gamma 5 here, but that's somehow the name that is out there. And both of these contribute to the measured value. And so you only get a linear combination of them. From different atoms, you could, to some extent, disentangle them, but these limits are then much weaker than what's up here. Now, within the standard model, we would get very small values for these quantities, for these electric dipole moments, because they enter only a 2 or 3 loop level, and the CKM matrix elements are small. So the standard model is very small. But new physics could potentially introduce a new CP violation at a much larger level, and you might worry that this doesn't make any sense because the limits are so strong. Actually, that's not generically quite true, and I want to show this for the example of the two Higgs doublet model, just as a representative toy model that is interesting. It's interesting because it contains two sources of CP violation, one from the scalar potential itself and one from the Yukawa coupling. So this is the scalar potential of the 2x doublet model. There are a bunch of couplings which are constrained by permitticity to be real, but some of them can be complex, shown here in red. And also, one of the vacuum expectation values could have a non-trivial complex phase. Typically, one constrains some of these quantities in order to avoid flavor-changing neutral currents, imposing a Z2 symmetry on the potential. Then we have to remove these two, but we still have two other complex parameters left. For the Yukawa sector, we can't really impose the Z2 symmetry because then there are no complex phases allowed. But we can go to a different framework where we what's called the aligned 2-Higgs doublet model, where both Higgses can couple to the fermions, but in a way that is proportional to each other. Then there are also no flavor-changing neutral currents. But we can have complex phases, one for all the up quarks, one for the down quarks, and one for the leptons. So if we have that, in total, we get a combination of both Higgs mixing from the scalar potential and from the Yukawa, and from the Yukawa couplings, which both contribute to CP violation. Now, for the electric dipole moments, these effects then enter through certain loop diagrams. For the electron dipole moment, these are two-loop Barzy diagrams where, you know, we have an inner loop here with a top quark or a W boson. And these are expressions which depend on these effective Yukawa couplings, so where both the mixings and the coupling effects are folded in. For the neutron electric dipole moment, the most important operator is this tri-gluon operator, which has a top loop here with the Higgs exchange there. And so if we compare what we get on these contributions from existing dipole limits, this looks something like this. So here, this is shown for the for a CP phase in the scalar potential. So this psi was the phase of the vacuum expectation value. And these lines, the dash dotted lines, are the current limit, even not taking into account this degeneracy between those two operators. So this is a kind of, you know, very conservative and very aggressive limit, so to say. But you can see as you vary some parameters in the potential, here, you know, these are values of the M12 parameter of a few hundred GeV, you find cases where you can have phases of order 0.1, which is not particularly small. Over here, this is a similar situation now for CP phase in the Yukawa couplings. These different colored bands are now different assumptions of how these two different operators contribute to the measured value of the dipole moment. And again, you can see order 0.1 CP phases are actually still allowed. So at the very end, let me quickly mention something on lepto flavor violation. I don't have a whole lot to say about that because, as David said, you know, there's not much theory in this, but there's still some. One way, for instance, to describe these experiments is to introduce lepton flavor violating operators beyond the standard model, which are suppressed by some power of a high scale. These are the set of operators that matter, and you can use them to relate the different quantities. So radiative decays with a photon, three lepton decays, or also actually lepton violating decays of the Z boson. And if you do that, you get these constraints on the various operators. So this is basically this ratio of a coupling constant divided by the scale squared. And depending on which operator you look at, different kinds of processes are more constraining. You know, the radiative decays or the three lepton decays and so on. Here's for mu e interactions, here for tau mu interactions. Generally, you see that if you assume the coupling is order one, these constrain scales of many, many TeV, very high scales. So actually, one might worry if renormalization group effects can play a role, and they might. So this is shown over here. So here are basically now these two parameters, the coupling constant and the scale, shown independently of each other. For some of these operators, there's not much running at all, like for the CE gamma, which is the yellow line. So this is just a straight line in this plot. But others have some noticeable RG effects, which accounts for this curving over here. All right, that's basically what I wanted to say. I might be out of time, so I guess I will not read my conclusions to you.
Thanks very much, Iris. Very nice talk. Questions here, Jesse.
A comment on the dark photon explanation of G minus 2. So I think with the rare pion decay, that basically the standard kinetic mixing scenario no longer is viable, and one has to go to the regime where the dark photon has an additional invisible decay on top of the kinetic mixing.
Yeah, sorry, what did you say with the rare what decay?
With rare pion decay, the Na48-2 experiment, which I think David showed, kind of wipes out the standard parameter space.
Right. Well, I mean, so yeah, it depends. I mean, so at the 95% confidence level, you can still live. Whether you say that's satisfying or not is, you know, up to your interpretation. But yeah, it's very constrained, I agree.
Oh, was he was showing invisible decay?
Invisible.
Oh, he was showing the invisible decay? How does Phoenix get a bound? I don't think the Phoenix
can give you a bound. This plot didn't include the invisible decay. No, this was just with standard model decays. Where was it? Here. Yeah. Yeah, the NA48 stuff falls somewhere in this region.
I wonder if you could calculate these light by light on these lattice calculations of light by light scattering. How do they handle the virtual nature of the photons?
The virtual nature of the photons is actually not the main problem. What is harder is, you know, if you put something in this loop here, how do you handle the virtual nature of those? For instance, so what people do is they say, well, light mesons contribute most to these loops, so you can look at pion loops and stuff like that.
No,
for instance.
I know, but I'm assuming that they can somehow do that, if at least for real photons. But how do they handle the external legs being off shell?
Well, so that the fact that the photons are off shell is not a problem, but of course what it involves
when you
is
say
that
not
the form
a problem.
Factor of the photon with the pion, say for example,
how can
moves
you say
away
it's
from
not a problem? There's two loop integrals there.
Yeah. Many hadronic form factors, exactly.
Exactly.
Right. And so they make assumptions about the type of these form factors, like, you know, for instance, you know, dipole assumptions or something of that sort, which are pretty much ad hoc, right? Nobody knows what the uncertainties of these assumptions are.
Good.
Any further questions?
There is, though, I should mention, you know, there's some chance to measure some of these form factors in a limited regime, of course. In principle, in the loop, you need to integrate up to infinity. But in a limited regime, you know, for instance, Bell 2 plans to measure some of these form factors, actually, for off-shell photons, particularly. So that will help.
Question is how?
How exactly do you know that, David?
I think the first test of this thing was to do the QED version of the light by light on the lattice. So they did that as an exercise. And
the actual measurement of the experiments of pion factor.
Oh, the off-shell form factor. No, that's a new program that's going to happen at Chloe and Bess. And there they just really tag these electrons which are off, you know, off-shell in a way, and then they look for pi zeros and stuff like that. That's
right.
There's a big industry to try to get database light by light, especially for the dominant pseudoscalar leading term. And although everybody agrees on what that is, that's a huge new industry that's just starting. To be honest, I've heard a bunch of talks. I'm having a real hard time getting my head around it.
All right. If there are no further questions, then let us thank Iris again. And with that, we can conclude the session.